Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will spotlight a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on their world. We'll uncover the historical context and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in.
So welcome, everyone, to the first ever episode of our new podcast. We are truly excited to take you on a trip back to the 60s and 70s, as we're going to share the stories of some of the most remarkable women of these decades.
From musicians to actresses and muses, we'll dive into these women's lives, uncovering who they really were and how they left their mark. We're starting out by posting a new episode every other week, and I'm actually going to break from the script almost immediately because, this is our first episode together. We're sort of combining our audiences, and, you know, your audience doesn't know me, my audience doesn't know you, so, I don't know, let's introduce ourselves. Who are you? What do you do?
Hi everyone, I'm Emma, I'm 25, and I make content all around the 60s and 70s, just sharing my love for the era, mainly the fashion, but also the music. I'm mainly on Instagram and YouTube, sometimes on other platforms, and now we're kind of like dipping our toes into podcasting. So basically, a couple of weeks ago, or basically at the beginning of the year, I really had this idea to make a podcast all about the women of the 60s and 70s, because that's just a huge interest of mine. And I feel like when we talk about these times, it's mostly the men and what they did. There's not a lot of light that goes on the women of these times. So I wanted to create this podcast, and I am so glad that I have Abby with me on this journey. So maybe you introduce yourself.
Thank you so much. Hi, I'm Abigail DeVoe. I run a series called Vinyl Monday, in which once a week, I sit down, I talk about the who, what, when, where, and why, and how I feel about albums in my extensive vinyl collection. I think we're at like 1,100 albums at this point. I'm running out of space.
Fascinating.
I am running out of space for this room. Yeah, I started as a music fan and then sort of tripped and fell into being a retrospective music critic. But again, like you said, my sphere of expertise, if you could call it that, the 60s and 70s, I talk about a lot of dudes, and I talk about a lot of dudes making music. I only covered women 6 or 7 times in Vinyl Monday's almost 3-year history and was ashamed. Then you reached out to me to co-host this podcast. On April 1st, so I thought it was a joke until you sent me the
I didn't know
yeah,
that!
Yeah, and then you sent me the full project proposal.
Oh,
I was like,
crazy.
Oh, you're serious about this, and I am all in. Yeah. So thank you so much for having me and sharing this idea with me. All right, let's get into things.
Yes, so for the first episode, there truly was only one woman to start with. The one that started it all for me, and that's Sharon Tate. She sparked the idea of this podcast and inspired me to create it, since her story and life always fascinated and touched me. She's, for me, truly one of those names inevitably connected with the 1960s through her tragic death. But many don't know a lot about her beside the gruesome murder. So I really wanted to shed a light on who she was, because she was an amazing and impressive woman. So today we'd like to introduce you to a young actress and beauty queen born in Dallas, Texas on January 24th of 1943.
Quote, "When I was in school, I dreamed about becoming a psychiatrist or a ballerina. Like most girls, I would dream about being a movie star too, but those dreams are the impossible kind, the kind you don't really set your heart on." Sharon Marie Tate entered the world as the cherished first child of Paul Tate, a career military officer affectionately known as PJ, and his wife Doris. Their union, just shy of a year old when Sharon arrived, was imbued with hopes and dreams for their precious daughter. They believed her to be the epitome of beauty and grace. Little did they know, this belief would be shared by many outside their immediate circle. Among Sharon's admirers were PJ's mother. Her adoration for her granddaughter knew no bounds. This fondness led to her submitting photographs of six-month-old Sharon to local toddler beauty contests. Little Sharon won the prestigious title of Miss Tiny Tot of Dallas and a $50 savings so bond. It is. So I want to quickly interject here and explain why a $50 savings bond is such a big deal. Bonds aren't really a thing anymore here in the States, unless your grandparents took out one for you when you were born. But back when they were commonplace, like when Sharon was born, bonds were considered one of the safest investments you could make. So you pay a little interest on it until you're able to gain access to that money. The savings bond I'm familiar with, kids will gain access when they're 18. So $50 in 1943 would be about $1,700 in today's money, but savings bonds increase in value over time. So once Sharon was 18, she'd have access to about $2,000 in today's money, which she could put towards starting her life. In America, women couldn't open their own bank accounts or apply for a credit card until 1974, so future financial independence was a big motivator for girls competing in beauty pageants. Sharon's Miss Tiny Tot title was not only representative of her undeniable charm, but a source of pride for the Tate family. But amidst moments of joy, the Tate family faced their fair share of challenges, particularly during Sharon's formative years. With PJ deployed at war, Doris shouldered the responsibilities of parenthood largely on her own. That's something we don't think of often regarding soldiers' wives in wartime. For however many months or years, they were effectively single parents.
Oh, just to loop in here real quick, I think that's really interesting because at that time, it was really unheard of for someone to be a single parent. So many people knew what it kind of was. But for these women, especially during those times, they were effectively single parents for large periods of times. And I truly think that that's really interesting in that sense of the story, because Sharon and her mom had that crazy strong bond that is really beautiful. And I think it is because that was basically all her mother had. She only had her daughter, no husband, nowhere.
They only had each other and whatever family was around them. Compounding their worries was Sharon's susceptibility to mysterious illnesses. She was a sick child. This often left her mother feeling helpless and anxious. Despite numerous visits to the hospital and consultations with medical experts, the root cause of Sharon's ailments eluded them. It was during one harrowing episode in which Sharon ran a high fever that Doris made a pivotal decision. Faced with the anguish, uncertainty, and her maternal instinct, she became Sharon's primary caregiver. She turned down further medical intervention in favor of her own care and intuition. As the Cold War loomed overhead and PJ's military obligations demanded frequent moves, the Tate family traversed the breadth of the nation. The United States is a huge country, not just population-wise, but geographically. So each move, you're throwing yourself into a wildly different culture, geography. Each move brought with it excitement and apprehension as they grappled with the uncertainties of military life and global tensions. Sharon remembered, quote, "I guess you could say that I was somewhat withdrawn from my classmates. I spent a good deal of time being a loner. I suppose that had something to do with the way we lived, always on the move, never living in one town very long. It's very hard to make lasting friendships that way. And my father was rather strict with me and my two younger sisters. He insisted on proper behavior and very often vetoed our choices of boyfriends. There was always a curfew. Whenever my sisters or I would go out on a date, we had to be home on time or else. But I never resented his authority. In fact, I'm thankful for my strict upbringing. I feel it's helped me learn discipline, and that's very important in this business."
Growing up with her parents as the steadfast pillars in her life, Sharon cultivated a deep and intimate bond with both of them. This familiar closeness took on new dimensions when at age 9, Sharon welcomed her little sister Deborah into the world. 5 years later, the family expanded once again with the arrival of a third daughter they named Patty. The warmth and hospitality exuded by the Tate household became a recurring theme in the recollections of those who crossed paths with Sharon and her family. Sharon herself was often described as embodying the same kindness and beauty attributed to her mother, a testament to the nurturing environment in which she was raised. I just quickly want to say, if it is a little loud in the background, there's a thunderstorm happening. I live on the top floor right underneath the roof, so I'm sorry.
Oh, it's all right. I didn't realize that the age gaps between Sharon and her sisters were so wide. You said she was 9 when Deborah was born, and then another 5 years later, so
14.
She was 14 years older than Patty.
That's honestly, I think, really interesting, because on one hand, that's probably because her dad was at war, so of course it would like take a little longer. But then I also think it is very interesting because it doesn't only mean that these girls kind of grew up in different times, like especially the 60s, with her being born like by the mid 40s, that meant that her youngest sister was born in like almost the 60s. So that's just such a evolving and changing time. And I also think, which we will come back later to in this episode, is how her sisters were influenced by the fact that their older sister was a famous actress, and how it like not only opened doors for them but showed them a different way of living, which was something that not a lot of women in the 50s, 60s, and 70s really knew of. As Sharon transitioned into her teenage years, her budding confidence and allure found expression in the realm of beauty pageants. With a string of victories under her belt, including titles such as Miss Richland and Miss Autoroma, Sharon's star began its ascension. Her undeniable charm and poise caught the attention of both admirers and industry insiders alike. The trajectory of Sharon's life took a monumentous turn when her father was reassigned to Italy. It was amidst the picturesque backdrop of this Mediterranean country that Sharon enrolled in Vicenza American High School. In 1960, fate intervened in the form of a magazine cover shoot for Stars and Stripes, catapulting Sharon into the spotlight. Clad in quintessential American attire, a one-piece swimsuit, cowboy hat, and boots, she radiated an aura of wholesome beauty that captured the imagination of advertising and film executives alike. Sharon's allure didn't go unnoticed by the entertainment industry, particularly when famed entertainer Pat Boone descended upon Italy to film his summer special. Talent scouts, drawn to Sharon's magnetic presence, wasted no time in recruiting her for the production. While initially hesitant, Sharon's parents eventually gave in, allowing her to embark on this new chapter of her budding career, with her devoted mother Doris by her side every step of the way. So I actually read a little about this, and it is really interesting because at first her parents didn't want her to go, and they only allowed her to go with her mom being there all the time and like standing by her side while filming. So Doris recalls in quotes, "The next day, Sharon came out of the costume trailer all dolled up. A tailored blue satin dress with a matching wide-brimmed hat made her the prettiest girl on the set until a gusting wind ripped away the hat and wildly tossed her hair into a gnarled mess. The shoot was equally disastrous. The gale force pushed the candle waves over the boat's edge, soaking the occupants and made Sharon seasick for days after. God knows why, but the experience of the Boone Show hooked Sharon on the entertainment industry."
I mean, roll with the punches, right?
Yeah, I think so. And honestly, I feel like this is very foreshadowing of her career, because the first thing that always happened is people met her and they all loved her. They all wanted her to be in her movies. But then also, we will see later on, she was in many kind of disastrous productions. So during the next couple of months, she starred as an extra in multiple films across Italy. And while working on a film titled Adventures of a Young Man, she began dating actor Richard Beimer, famous for his part as Tony in West Side Story. And I feel like to the younger people, he is mainly known as Audrey Horne's dad in Twin Peaks. Soon the two started going out, and Richard won the Tate family's sympathy. Before they found out, he was prompting her to go to Hollywood. Her mother recalls the scene and quotes, "Sharon said, 'Richard said he'll introduce me to his agent in California.' 'Maybe after college,' PJ said absently. 'I'm not going to college. I'm going to California,' she timidly announced. That caught his attention. 'The hell you are!' The odds tipped in Sharon's favor. PJ received his next assignment. 'Wouldn't you know it, we were going to San Pedro, California, just south of Los Angeles.' The news of the transfer led to a compromise. Sharon would go to California 2 months ahead of the family under the condition that she attend college while pursuing an acting career. Even later, she'd credited Baymer with convincing her to go to Hollywood, saying, 'Richard told me I should be in pictures, and I believed him.'"
With her whole family now being in California with her, Sharon was ready to take Hollywood by storm, but despite her connections and good looks, her big break didn't happen right away. She auditioned for several parts, but nothing seemed to work out. That is, until an audition for Petticoat Junction, where Filmways exec Marty Ransohoff saw her and signed her on the spot. They wanted to make her a star. Soon, Sharon's days were filled with acting lessons with Lee Strasberg, singing, dancing, even learning to walk and talk a certain way. Ditching her southern accent would help her land more roles. Just like that, 3 years went by. Sharon started out with Harold Gefsky's agent, who later said, quote, "Sharon was an open, honest, smart, and straightforward person. One of the most beautiful people I have ever met in my life, and always, I can't emphasize on how beautiful she was, inside and out. Sharon was well-educated and impressed people with her honesty. She never changed from the time she arrived in Hollywood until the time she left us."
I feel like this is interesting because Harold Gefsky, he was Richard Baymer's agent, so when he came along and kind of was like, "Hey, could you sign my girlfriend?" he could have been like, no, like, he wasn't obligated to do that, but he saw Sharon and, like, on the spot was just so fascinated by her. And I feel like this is something that comes up over and over again in this story, that she was so beautiful and so talented that people just wanted to work with her.
And she was so beautiful that she would be dismissed, and then she would get the script in her hand, she would do the screen test, and the agents, the producers, the directors, they were instantly on board. So soon, Sharon found work in commercials. To support herself, she continued modeling. She shared an apartment with actress Sheila Wells. It was small and a little cramped, seeing as each girl had their own dog living
with
them.
That's my favorite part.
I certainly know how that is, even though my dog is small. He takes up so much space. As young working women in a big city, they enjoyed the independence of living alone. They spent a lot of time together out on the town. Sharon even introduced Sheila to her future husband. When talking about Sharon, Sheila said she, quote, "was so overwhelmingly, so incredibly beautiful that anyone not knowing her might think it took a lot to live with such a beauty. But you see, that was the other thing about Sharon. With all her beauty, everyone loved her. I never heard anyone say a bad word about her, not even another actress. And in this town, that's not a rarity, it's an impossibility." Gefsky soon introduced Sharon to Herb Brower, who instantly saw potential. He thought she was the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen, envisioning her in big motion pictures. He introduced her to one of the last old Hollywood producers, Martin Ransohoff. Old Hollywood meaning an artifact of the 1930s studio system. You know, when you discover an actress, you essentially assigned her an image with a new name and backstory and contract them for roles surrounding that image. 5 minutes into their first meeting, Brower called his assistant to draw up the contract and get Sharon's parents saying, quote, "I'm gonna make this girl a star." Since she was only 19, she couldn't sign the contract for herself, so her father, PJ, signed on her behalf.
Just quickly looping in here because of the entire Hollywood studio system. So I come from a movie background, so this is a time very interesting to me because the 60s saw this kind of studio system vanish. So basically a lot of young directors would come in. They didn't want it to work with the big studios. They kind of did their own thing. And I think it is very interesting that Sharon came onto the scene during this time, because in the beginning she was very much still part of that studio system, but you will see that she later kind of broke free from it, going for more difficult roles. And that's something that if she would have come to the scene 10 years earlier would have never been possible.
Yeah, she had a great opportunity afforded to her from, you know, the time she arrived in Hollywood. If she'd arrived earlier, like say in the Marilyn Monroe years, she would have been cast for one role, one type, for about 10 years and then forced to retire. Soon, Sharon got a small role on the popular television series The Beverly Hillbillies. This is so funny coming from I'm American, and Beverly Hillbillies is kind of this like old school TV institution, like not even something your dad watches reruns of, but like your grandpa.
That's crazy. I just wanted to say that even though she was during the perfect time at the perfect place, I feel like she also took a bunch of opportunities, and we will see this later, that like she didn't turn down roles because she thought that she was too good for it or anything. She was always like, okay, I'm going to take this part and I'm going to do my best. And she proved herself over and over again.
And I mean, Exhibit A, Beverly Hillbillies. Yeah, she wore a wig to hide her blonde hair and appeared for 2 seasons as Janet, the young assistant to the long-suffering Miss Jane, played by Nancy Culp. Ransohoff's plan was easy but effective. He gave Sharon discreet parts and small roles at first to learn her craft before sending her on auditions for bigger pictures. As a result, Sharon learned how to take on the look and conduct of a movie star. Her sister Patty explained, quote, "In my eyes, there were 2 versions of Sharon. There was her well-groomed public persona, and then there was my sister with her long straight hair, no makeup, wearing jeans and a t-shirt. The Sharon I identified with slouched when she sat down, bit her nails to the skin, and chewed on her lower lip when she was nervous. Her natural voice had a high timbre and a slight Texas drawl that thickened when she was excited or tired. There were days when her clumsiness got the best of her, like when she managed to break her leg getting out of bed."
I love that.
"Balancing a checkbook." Yeah. There are photos of her with the big old cast on her leg,
right?
That's
so funny.
Oh my gosh. She had a great sense of humor about it, though.
She did.
Quote, "Balancing a checkbook was a challenge, which she didn't care to master. Overcoming her shyness was a constant, well-hidden strain. She had a knack for making a mundane story interesting and loved to make people laugh. As headstrong a person could be, when she made a decision, an army couldn't change her mind." And I think that's so true for the chapters of her life we're about to enter into.
Certainly, it truly is. So now we're going to talk about a very pivotal meeting in Sharon's life. Because while her agent had her trained to be a Hollywood star, he also gave her a physical makeover. A part of that was getting a new haircut by a hairstylist named Jay Sebring. Back then, she didn't know how significant that meeting was, how much of a bond they would form, and that they would die side by side. But when they met in October of 1964, they immediately became friends. Jay, whose real name was Thomas John Comer, came from Alabama and had fought in the Korean War when he came to LA to attend a beauty school, and later, with only $500 to his name, opened his salon. He worked up to 13 hours a day, sleeping in the back room, and soon became beloved by many Hollywood stars. Well, the usual haircut at the time was between $1 and $2. Jay charged $50 and cut the hair of Hollywood legends like Warren Beatty and Steve McQueen. One thing I found really interesting in particular in researching this was his connection to Jim Morrison.
That's where his name is familiar to me! Okay, sorry, it just all came to me.
Yes.
Continue.
No, it's all good. Jim went to his salon in the 1960s, and his signature long hairdo was cut by Jay. The two became friends, and he later introduced Jim to Sharon and her future husband, Roman Polanski, with Jim Morrison also attending their wedding. So that means...
That's wild.
It is, right? Because it means they didn't just meet and were like, "Hi, I'm Sharon, I'm Jim." It was truly like they met and they became friends. So I feel like Jay must have had a great eye for matching people.
Yeah, and it's a testament to how insular the Laurel Canyon community was in the 60s. Everybody knew each other. You get like really crazy friend groups like Alice Cooper, Mickey Dolan from the Monkees, Ringo Starr all hanging out together because there were no pretenses. Also, I don't think I would ever invite Jim Morrison to my wedding, especially if there were an
Me
open
neither.
Bar. I don't want to think
that
what
seems
would
like
happen.
A crazy thing to do. But I love that. And honestly, one thing that I also learned about Jay is that he not only was very influential with all these people, but he was also a very influential hairstylist, up to the point that people who go to cosmetology school nowadays still learn about him and his kind of hairstyles because it was so revolutionary. So while not being an actor or working in the movie industry, Jay knew everyone, and his connection helped many young stars like Bruce Lee and Sharon, and it really helped them launch their careers. Jay had a back room where he cut the hair of the famous Hollywood stars, and that's where Sharon spent a lot of time sitting in the corner watching Jay work and getting to know Hollywood's in crowd. One day, author Dominic Dune got his hair cut by Jay when he met Sharon. He said, in quotes, "She looked so young that I thought at first she was coming here after school. She wore her blonde hair straight and long. She was quiet and friendly and smiled a lot at our conversation. Jay was so proud of her. He couldn't stop looking at her. It was as if he couldn't believe he had a girlfriend that beautiful. I've never seen a guy more madly in love than Jay was with Sharon."
Aww.
Yeah, it's sweet, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Jay didn't only win Sharon's heart. Soon her entire family was fond of him, and the two decided to get married. In quotes, "He done it by the books and arrived early the day before to ask for my permission. He actually used the ridiculous words, 'May I have your blessing to take your daughter's hand in marriage?' I stifled a laugh, popped open a couple of beers and told him, 'Sure, what the hell?' The next day, he and Sharon came for dinner. In the middle of grilling steaks on the barbecue, Jay got down on his knee and popped the question to Sharon as I watched the romantic spectacle. The urge to laugh was there again, but this time it was stifled by the thought that we gotten damn lucky to have Jay for our son-in-law. He was a good man and good to Sharon. What more could a father ask for?" Her dad, PJ, recalled.
That's so sweet. Even that Jay would do something so old school as to ask her father for her hand in marriage. And, you know, I don't know how the Tate family was specifically in that regard, but, you know, the southern states, like, you know, your Texas, your Florida, your Georgia, your Carolinas, traditions and institutions like that are very important. It's not just, you know, a tradition to uphold. It's a level of respect, because you're not just joining people in marriage, you're joining whole families. It's a big deal.
Yeah, truly. And I think given that the Tate family, they were three daughters, they had a really, really close bond. And I think it is also, it says a lot about Jay that he came and proposed in front of the entire family with her sisters, with everyone there. He just knew how much that would mean to Sharon.
It's a really special moment to share.
Yeah.
The 1960s saw a rise in horror films. Soon, Sharon would be one of the many actresses making her name from these movies. After unsuccessfully auditioning for the role of Lysel in the screen adaptation of Rodgers and Hammerstein's The Sound of Music, Emma, you're telling me that there's an alternate universe in which we got Sharon Tate singing I Am 16 going
Isn't
on 17?
Isn't that crazy?
I'm mad we didn't get that.
Yeah, me too. And I'm mad that there's no, like, leaked tape or anything about that. I bet she would have been amazing.
Yeah, are there any roles that, did she take any musical roles in her lifetime?
I don't think so. So a lot of people said that she really loved music. That's something that comes up over and over again. Particularly the Doors seemed to be her favorite band, which given she was friends with Jim Morrison. But I feel like a lot of people say that she loved to sing and she loved to dance, but for some reason that never really worked out in her career. And I think a big part is that later in her career, she really wanted to have these serious roles. She wanted to be in drama movies. And that's not typically something that goes along with musical numbers. But I honestly think that that might have truly been something for her.
Yes, we'll never know. Anyway, the studio called her back for another movie called Eye of the Devil. That just sounds like the complete opposite to The Sound of Music.
It's funny that they were doing those two movies at the same time. It seems so odd.
She hopped on a flight to France, joining co-stars David Niven and Kim Novak. At first, the director was hesitant to work with her since she was so young and had little to no experience. It was a difficult role, so production agreed that if, after the first 2 weeks, Sharon wasn't quite measuring up, they'd recast her part. She portrayed Odile, a mysterious girl with psychic powers, but the camera loved Sharon. About her time on set, director J. Lee Thompson said, quote, we all realized that she was a girl who was tremendously exciting. She had that thing that you can't really explain, star projection. I think this girl is going to be a big star. Sharon starred in a couple more movies until she was signed on for The Fearless Vampire Killers by up-and-coming Polish director Roman Polanski. Polanski had just gained international fame for his first movie, Knife in the Water, about a husband and wife accompanied on a boating trip by a young male hitchhiker who spurs a number of escalating confrontations between the couple. With a critically acclaimed and box office hit film under his belt, Polanski was on to Hollywood for his next big film.
I think it is important to quickly loop here to talk about Roman Polanski for a little. He's a very controversial figure in the art scene and one of the people always coming to mind in the discussion of separating the art from the artist. I read his biography as a teenager who was in love with all of his movies, and to this day his movies are some of my favorite. Honestly, I urge you to watch them. He truly made some incredible films and it is a little overshadowed by everything that I'm about to tell you about him. But if you can and want to separate the art from the artist, I really recommend you to watch those movies because they're great. He was born in France to Polish parents in 1933, and his family moved back to Poland in 1937, getting trapped in the Krakow ghetto. His family was split here and partially killed, but young Roman survived by concealing his Jewish heritage. In his biography, there are gruesome details on how his mother got killed first because she was pregnant, and how his father cut a hole into a fence for young Roman to escape. I'm not telling you all of this to justify what he did later in life, but I think it is important for this story to understand where he came from. By the time Sharon met him, he was just a talented young director on his way to become one of Hollywood's greatest stars. Before I get into his controversy, I'd like to put a trigger warning here. The next part is going to discuss sexual relationships with a minor. If you don't want to listen to that, please just skip ahead. So in 1977, Polanski was arrested and charged with the drugging and raping of a 13-year-old girl. As a result of a plea bargain, he pleaded guilty to the lesser offense of unlawful sex with a minor. In 1978, after learning that the judge planned to reject his plea deal and impose a prison term instead of probation, he fled to Paris. A number of other women have later accused Roman Polanski of raping them when they were teenagers. An Interpol red notice was issued for his arrest, and he rarely leaves France. He didn't stop and is still making movies, even winning an Oscar in 2003 that he accepted via Skype. His court case is very controversial after the young girl, after years of this happening, forgave him and said that she'd be okay with him back in the country. Anyway, I think that this is an important piece of context on Roman Polanski. But for this story, all of this didn't really came into play because Sharon didn't live long enough to be there when this happened. So in 1967, Roman Polanski was looking for a young actress to be part of his new film, The Fearless Vampire Killers. He originally wanted Jill St. John, but Ranzohoff insisted Sharon would be a better choice. Sharon went to do a screen test as well as going out to dinner with him two times. On both occasions, Roman sat there watching Sharon closely without either of them saying a word. After their second dinner, Roman invited her back to his apartment, and after lighting candles, he excused himself, leaving Sharon on her own. In quotes, "A short while later, he came back, storming into the room like a madman, and he was wearing a Frankenstein mask. I let out a blood-curdling scream, and while I was still crying from the scare, he was calling Ranzohoff to tell him that the part in the film was mine," Sharon recalls.
Good lord, that's... I mean, that's insane. One way to audition an actress. Okay. Fearless Vampire Killers was shot in the Alps. While Roman was demanding, and occasionally unhinged from the sounds of it, he also threw himself into promoting Sharon. He arranged for her to appear on the cover of Vogue magazine wearing her red wig and gothic costume. She also appeared in character in the March 1967 issue of Playboy. Roman took the photos of her himself. That's interesting.
Yeah.
By the time filming wrapped, Sharon and Roman were seeing each other. Thus, she broke the news to Jay that the engagement was off. Jay insisted on meeting Roman first. The two went out to dinner, both admitted to not liking each other at all at first, but after getting over the ex-boyfriend, new boyfriend,
that must have been so awkward. They became friends.
Oh, yeah. To be a fly on the wall of that dinner. Jay was a big part of Sharon and Roman's life together. While Jay, on the surface, seemed happy for the two, losing Sharon contributed to him turning to the world of drugs and self-destruction. He never left her side. Many speculated he was waiting in the wings for Roman to screw up so he could swoop in and win Sharon back. But Sharon was madly in love with Roman, ecstatic about her new relationship. Quote, "Roman is strong and so true, so honest. I don't like glamour boys. I've learned a lot about me from being with Roman. My definition of love is being full, complete. It makes everything lighter. Beauty is something you see, love is something you feel. He's wise and wonderful and brilliant, and he knows everything. I can't play games. I have friends, older women, who tell me I'm foolish to let Roman know how deeply I care about him. They tell me all sorts of things, like keep a man guessing, men become bored with too much devotion. They tell me I'm being foolish. Well, foolish I am." Roman said, quote, "She was a unique person. It's difficult to describe her character. She was just utterly good. The kindest human being I ever met, with an extreme patience to live with me. Was proof of her patience, because to be near me must be an ordeal." You said it, Roman, not me. "She never had a bad temper. She was never moody. She enjoyed being a wife. The press and the public knew of her physical beauty, but she also had a beautiful soul, and this is something that only her friends knew about."
That's such a sweet, sweet little quote. I need to loop in here real quick and tell you my very personal Roman Polanski story. That's not so personal to me, but rather to my mom. So The Fearless Vampire Killers, it's such a cult classic. Especially here, yes. Like there's a musical, there's everything. It goes so, so far. And so when that musical first kind of like went big, Roman came for the rehearsals to just kind of like oversee them because, you know, if you didn't know, I live in Germany, so he's allowed to travel here, right? Okay, so he did that. And where in my hometown where they play all the musicals, like the musical theater, on top of that is a kind of like business building, so like a lot of offices. And one day my mom was working there and she gets in the elevator and she's like, that man, he seems familiar. But she didn't quite like pinpoint it. And she was like, well, it was that like rather short man. He had this weird concentrated look on his face. And then he gets off and he turns around and my mom's like, oh, that's Roman Polanski. And she came home and told me that. And I was like such a movie geek growing up. So of course I knew who he was. And I was like so starstruck. That was also before I knew about his like problematic personal life. But I thought it was so funny, honestly, to me. It's so funny that she met him and she was like, it must have been such a crazy situation.
It's so funny that your mom called him short.
Isn't it? My mom's short. Listen, we're all short. But like, this is something that comes up over and over again. I saw interviews of Sharon where people were literally like, why are you with this odd looking man? Because Sharon was so beautiful. And like Roman, there's nothing wrong with his appearance. I don't want to say that, but like he's not the classic Hollywood kind of pretty, attractive, handsome guy.
They're an odd couple.
Yeah. And so people were really like they thought it was weird, but then she must have had sort of a type because Jay is a very similar type than Roman. He's also short. He's also very talented, really great at something.
Driven, strong personalities.
Oh, truly. So that must have been the kind of guy she really liked. Soon the two were one of the in couples in Hollywood. And while dating him, Sharon tried LSD about 16 times, as Roman would say. According to him, she enjoyed it, but feared that if she take one more trip, her mind would be gone, so she gave it up. In quotes, "On one of our first meetings, I had a tiny amount. We split it and then spent all night talking. In the morning, she started flipping out and screaming. I was scared to death. I couldn't do anything for her. Later she said, see, I told you, I can't take it anymore. This is the end of it." And it was the end of it for her and for me.
Yeah, worth noting, LSD was a lot stronger in 1967 than it is today. I'm honestly thankful for that. Because you didn't know what you were messing with.
And it just also wasn't as known. Like, people generally didn't know what was happening. And I think LSD was legal until 1967.
66.
Oh, right, 66. So this was right on the edge of LSD not being legal anymore. So I guess people were like, well, it couldn't be that bad. Last year, people were able to still do it and consume it even legally. So I feel like in this generation, especially in the art scene, artists, musicians, actresses, they pretty much all tried LSD. And I think it is very quintessential Roman that he can recall that it was 16 times. He's the kind of guy I imagine who would write that down and remember it for life.
Very particular.
Yeah, I think he truly was, or is. The two went out to nightclubs, art shows, and concerts, taking short trips to the ocean and Europe, but Sharon was eager to work as an actress. This is another thing I was quite surprised to find out about her. In an interview, she once said, in quotes, "When I love, I love. I won't marry for a long time. I'll give up acting the second I'm married. I believe a wife must immerse herself completely in her husband and family, and that's what I intend to do. A few women can handle marriage and a career successfully at the same time. I would never marry just to be respectable. It's just a piece of paper and a lovely financial setup. I've learned great happiness from being with Roman that I didn't have before. Why would I want to ruin a perfect affair by trying to get into a mediocre marriage for society's sake?" I found this interesting because I feel like when we talk about the 60s, it always has the spirit of free culture and progress, and people tend to forget that the 60s were insanely close to the 1950s.
That comes from a quote from Michelle Phillips from the Laurel Canyon documentary. And she was sort of talking about her romantic life. And she said the 60s were closer to the 50s as far as values went.
So yeah, in the 1960s, the classic role models of men and women were still the norm. And actresses generally retired as soon as they got married and had kids.
But that was still years away. Right now, Sharon was enjoying a high point in her career and quickly followed up Fearless Vampire Killers with a starring role in the comedy Don't Make Waves. Sharon played Malibu, a young, sexy skydiver who catches the eye of Tony Curtis's character. Almost the entire movie was shot on the beach. While it opened to mixed reviews, those same reviews praised Sharon for her acting. She made $750 a week, equal to about $7,000 today, which was
That's very good money
for a young woman in 1967.
It's still, yeah.
Yeah.
Imagine making $7,000 a week. That's insane.
Shoot.
One kid never.
Someday, maybe. Oddly enough, her management decided to promote Don't Make Waves as her first picture. To promote her in the movie, pictures of Sharon wearing a skimpy bikini were distributed. She became the official spokeswoman for Coppertone suntan lotion. In one of the ads, Sharon appeared in her famous bikini, being carried on a surfboard by a group of sun-kissed young surfers. I just saw this referenced in a Sabrina Carpenter music video. She's got like all the surfers holding up the surfboard.
That comes
She's dancing
from that.
And singing her song. Yeah,
it's
comes
crazy.
From those ads. Emma found quite a few sources stating she could have been Mattel's inspiration for Malibu Barbie. That tracks, considering she played a character named Malibu, she was bubbly and fun, and had long blonde hair like the doll. While Sharon loved to travel, she enjoyed filming in California because it meant she was close to her family. Her sister Patty recalled, quote, "Sharon took me to Malibu Beach while she finished her scene for the movie Don't Make Waves. I built a sandcastle made of tightly packed walls and towers. Castle construction turned into a group effort when the film crew helped me with the details. The special effects men dug a moat. Tony Curtis placed a small crab in the center and then crowned him king of the fortress. As a final touch, the prop man placed a miniature flag on the highest towers." Even with her family and the Malibu sunshine, Sharon was unhappy while making the movie. Roman was still in Europe, wrapping production for the Fearless Vampire Killers that he not only directed, but had a lead role in. Like most of the cast, Sharon wasn't exactly thrilled about Don't Make Waves. It's silly, with a basic story and flat dialogue. One might even call it camp. But Sharon had another concern. With her being promoted as a beautiful blonde in a little bikini, she feared her career would go into a direction she didn't care for. Studios considered her a blonde bombshell rather than a serious actress. Sharon wanted to be a serious actress in dramas with hard-hitting, difficult roles.
There's one more thing I'd like to add to the Don't Make Waves production, and that is that I found out that Sharon nearly died while making this movie. So she apparently did a lot of her stunts herself, and for one scene, she jumped from a plane into a pool wearing a parachute for safety. But then when she jumped, the parachute deployed at the wrong time and it covered the entire pool, and Sharon was underneath the parachute in the water. So apparently they got her out at the right time, but it really scared her. And I can only imagine how that must have felt.
That's scary. That's serious stuff.
But those difficult roles that she was so eager to get were really hard to get. And both Sharon and her management knew that her beauty was her biggest asset. While she had a lot of talent and was a natural in front of the camera, she hadn't been acting for long enough to be considered for those parts, and so her management got her a role in a little movie called Valley of the Dolls. Looking back, this would become the movie she's most known for. In 1967, most people in America had either read or heard of the famous Jacqueline Susan novel, so when the news of a movie adaptation broke, it caused a stir in Hollywood. Many established and well-known actresses wanted to be in it, and when Sharon landed the role of Jennifer North, many were surprised. While Sharon wasn't fond of the story, feeling that the book was a little trashy, she also acknowledged its redeeming qualities. Understanding the dynamics of the industry, she believed that delivering a strong performance, even in a bad movie, could open doors to more substantial roles. Valley of the Dolls portrays the lives of three women in the entertainment industry. It explores their pursuit of success, their struggles with addiction to prescription drugs, and the consequences of fame. The movie delved into themes of ambition, friendship, love, and the darker side of Hollywood. Sharon portrayed a character reminiscent of Marilyn Monroe, a superstar shrouded in tragedy, whose life ends in a suicide. Her role as Jennifer North in the film depicted another archetype, the innocent beauty who enters Hollywood only to be transformed into a tortured soul. Sharon shared similarities with Jennifer. Both were aware of the industry's emphasis on physical appearance and innocence. They were both involved with European art filmmakers. However, Sharon also bore resemblance to Marilyn Monroe, the rumored inspiration for Jennifer's character. Both women were iconic blondes with stunning figures and suffered mistreatment by producers who exploited their sex appeal. Like Marilyn, Sharon rejected her dumb blonde image to marry an intellectual. Trying to appear less perfect to be considered for different roles, Sharon began to point out her physical flaws. She told a friend about the scar on her face, especially the noticeable mark near her left eye. It was done by corrugated tin when she was very young, and she was very proud of it. "It's me," in quotes, Sharon said. Sharon demonstrated her commitment to advancing her career by enduring the challenges of filming Valley of the Dolls. Despite the high cost, the production was beset by numerous problems, with director Mark Robson proving to be particularly difficult to work with, singling out Sharon for criticism. However, it's possible he was aiming to help her refine her acting skills, as he later praised her vulnerability to Polanski, acknowledging her promising future. Meanwhile, Judy Garland, facing her own struggles with addiction mirroring her characters, had to be replaced by Susan Hayworth due to her reliability issues. Throughout it all, tension simmered between the other two leads, Patty Duke and Barbara Parkins, each vying for the spotlight and seeking to maximize their roles. When filming had finally wrapped, everyone was relieved. Reflecting on her character, Sharon said, in quotes, "I am like Jennifer because she's relatively simple, a victim of circumstances beyond her control. But I have more confidence in myself. I am so afraid of hurting other people's feelings. I don't speak out when I should. I get into big messes. That way, I will never be another Marilyn Monroe. But I had to do what they wanted at first. All American men are neurotic. All they care about is having sex."
With Valley of the Dolls filmed in California once again, her young sister Patty visited her on set a couple times. She recalls sitting next to Sharon in the makeup chair while they transformed her, applying a heavy base of makeup. They used a light color to conceal her scars and freckles, and a darker one to emphasize the contours of her face, her very high cheekbones. Take that, people who say contouring didn't exist in the 60s! Her eyes were rimmed in black liner, topped with false lashes, and the makeup artist brushed deep brown color on her light eyebrows. While Sharon's natural hair was long and blonde, she wore a wig of even longer, even blonder hair. The costume designers put her in a gold beaded dress, and she stood with her back straight and her chin held high. Quote, her voice was two octaves lower, with a hint of a European accent. Everything was false, from the top of her head to the lift under her breast to the red nails on her fingers. It was Sharon the movie star, Patty said. Despite the difficulties of shooting, many were eager for this film to come out. The novel was a big hit, and costume designer William Travilla praised Sharon in an interview with Screen Stories magazine. Quote, Sharon Tate is divine, a real find. Just wait and see what happens when the critics and public see her in Valley of the Dolls. Sharon has everything Marilyn Monroe had, and more. She has the fascinating yet wholly feminine strength of a Dietrich or a Garbo, a classically beautiful face, an exciting figure, the kind of sex appeal and personality appeal to become as glittering a star as Betty Davis, Joan Crawford, Rita Hayworth, Lana Turner, and Elizabeth Taylor. Very high praise.
Yes.
On the evening of November 14th, 1967, Valley of the Dolls premiered in Venice aboard the cruise liner, the Italia.
I love that detail.
Many movie critics witnessed what they described as one of the worst films they'd ever seen. One of the most disappointing films of all time.
Imagine just being in a movie and that's like the main thing.
Oh,
that must have been heart-wrenching for her.
My soul would just crumple up. Some test audiences even thought it was a comedy. Reviews were not good. Nevertheless, the film was a box office hit and is something of a cult classic today. While Sharon was busy in California filming Valley of the Dolls, Roman was in New York filming Rosemary's Baby with Mia Farrow.
Another fantastic Roman Polanski film, I'm sorry.
I'd say that's the film he's most known for nowadays, yes?
I think so too.
The three became close friends when Sharon met her on one of her visits. While in New York, she also did a photo shoot for Esquire magazine. Sharon posed in a black miniskirt while toting a rifle. And so, 1967 ended, and proved it was the year Sharon's career finally took off.
In quotes, meanwhile, Roman and Sharon continued on their silent, non-public ways. They hung out on beaches away from the Hollywood phoniness, as Sharon puts it, in bars with guys in jeans in Paris and London, where guys walk down King's Roads with cowboy hats and rhinestones. Just as Sharon was becoming deeply and inextricably a star, she was falling as deeply and inextricably in love, says Barbara Perkins, who starred alongside Sharon in Valley of the Dolls. I like Sharon and Roman. They do everything they want to do and don't care what anybody says. Upon completing their respective films, Sharon and Roman returned to London, where they established a shared residence. They became fixtures on the vibrant London social scene, often spotted alongside luminaries like Mia Farrow, Peter Sellers, and Warren Beatty. Certain publications even dubbed them the groovy couple of the year. Their social calendar brimmed with elite parties, fine dining, and nights at exclusive discotheques. Despite not being married, their unmarried status added to their allure, considered charming by their circle. They epitomized a rejection of societal norms, embracing love and enjoyment freely.
You know what that reminds me of? Sort of relishing in unmarriedness and sort of the freedom of the 60s. That reminds me of Jane Birkin and
Sergei
Gainsbourg.
I know you were going to say that.
They were never married.
Yes.
And they were also kind of an odd couple, but fell into the same archetype. Anyway, continue.
I feel like people forget that during this time, like even coming from Jane Birkin, having children with someone and not being married, that was kind of like scandalous. And for them, like we're just talking about they didn't live together formally or anything. They were just apparently spending a lot of time together and people saw that they were dating and they were just confused why they wouldn't get married sooner. But that was all about to end because in 1968, they decided to formalize their relationship, stunning the public. And that was truly big, big news. With the decision made, they swiftly organized a grand wedding. Sharon enlisted Barbara Perkins, her co-star from Valley of the Dolls, as her maid of honor and embarked on the quest for the perfect wedding gown. And just like their relationship, this wedding was far from traditional. On January 20th, in 1968, the couple got married and the Associated Press reported, in quotes, "American actress Sharon Tate wore flowers in her hair for her wedding at the Chelsea Register office Saturday to Polish film director Roman Polanski. Miss Tate, a star of the movie Valley of the Dolls, had on a silk mini dress. Polanski also favored green and a Regency-style suit," said Miss Tate, 25. "Roman and I plan to stay in England for a week. Then we will fly to California for a real honeymoon." Another article enlisted the guest list, which read like a filmland who's who. John Mills, Lawrence Harvey, Anthony Newley, Joan Collins, Leslie Caron, Michael Caine, Mike Sarin, and Peyton Play's girl Barbara Perkins. Musicians Jim Morrison and the Mamas and the Papas also attended the wedding alongside Wojciech Frykowski, who Roman had known since his childhood, and his girlfriend Abigail Folger, heiress to the Coffee Imperium. Their wedding caused a stir in London, with passersby stopping to get a glimpse look at the newlyweds. Sharon and Roman moved into the Chateau Marmont in Los Angeles for a few months until they arranged to lease Patty Duke's home on Summit Ridge Drive in Beverly Hills during the latter part of 1968. The Polanski house was often full of strangers, and Sharon regarded the casual atmosphere as part of the free spirit of the time, saying that she did not mind who came into her home, as her motto was live and let live. Her close friend Leslie Caron commented that the Polanskis were too trusting, in quotes, to the point of recklessness, and that she had been alarmed by it.
To the outside world, their marriage looked ideal. Robert Evans, friend to the couple and producer of Rosemary's Baby, recalls, quote, "Just about the only really happily married couple I knew in Hollywood were Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. Coming from a childhood of horror in Nazi-occupied Poland, Roman couldn't believe he was the husband of this milk-fed American beauty. Sharon's movie career was just beginning to heat up after Valley of the Dolls. In Roman's eyes, she was already the brightest star in the world. Around his gentle, sun-kissed bride, he was like a child who's just seen his first Christmas tree light up." In private, however, there were serious problems from the beginning. For one thing, there was the matter of Sharon's career. She was reluctant to accept any special help from her influential husband, saying she'd be thrilled to death to do another Polanski film, but he had to ask her first. She wouldn't even dream of asking him for a role, but would have loved for him to consider her. Sharon also broke ties with Rantzehoff since Roman didn't like him. She promised him 25% of her earnings over the next 4 years. She agreed to these terms only so she could have the freedom of trying out for the more sophisticated roles she'd been after. Rumors of Roman's infidelity dogged their union from day one, extending into Sharon's friend group. Lawrence Harvey explained, quote, "Marriage vows meant nothing to him." But he continues with, quote, "Few men have adored a woman as much as Roman adored Sharon." After the wedding, Sharon's career was going steady. In March of 68, Newsweek called her one of the new American beauties, saying, quote, "Astoundingly photogenic and infinitely curvaceous, Sharon Tate is one of the most smashing young things to hit Hollywood in a long time." She began as the invention of wheeler dealer Martin Rantzehoff, and in 5 years on the Hollywood treadmill, she has, surprisingly, made progress. In fact, in her last film, Valley of the Dolls, she managed to be the only living doll. Now married to the brilliant and volatile Polish director Roman Polanski, perhaps she will begin to fulfill her tremendous potential. Remembering her husband's repulsion, she dreams, "I'd like to be an American Catherine Deneuve." Alongside Faye Dunaway, Catherine was one of Sharon's biggest role models and admired how she played the sensitive, beautiful, and deep parts with such grace and intelligence. But Sharon still struggled with her public picture. Sometimes she sighs, "I think it would be better to be a sex symbol because at least I would know where I was." But she adds quickly, "I'd lose my mind."
I truly think that this is a very important and interesting part about her life. She's always going back and forth about being viewed as this Hollywood sex symbol and wanting to do deeper and more difficult acting roles. I feel like for some parts her beauty got in the way, and while she had so much potential, she never got to play those parts. I think this is one of the biggest tragedies of this story. We will never know what could have happened. Maybe she would have gone on to play those roles, like the women that she adored so much. Tate's first film after she left Rantzehoff was called The Wrecking Crew. Also starring Dean Martin, it was the fourth movie in the Matt Helm action comedy series, and Sharon played Freya Carlson, a fellow spy posing as a Danish tour guide. She did many of her own stunts, thanks in part to training she received from Hollywood newcomer and material arts advisor Bruce Lee. This is now a pretty well-known fact after it was so prominently featured in Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. The two hit it off so well that she invited Bruce Lee to her home, where he also gave Polanski some instructions. I bet they had like a little session of teaching some kind of tricks.
I mean, getting martial arts lessons from Bruce Lee.
That must have been something.
That's like, I can't even fathom that.
Like many of the other movies, critics panned it, but praised Sharon personally. The Hollywood Reporter review wrote, in quotes, "Sharon Tate reveals a pleasant affinity to scatterbrained comedy and comes as close to walking away with this picture as she did in a radically different role in Valley of the Dolls." The New York Times agreed, in quotes, "The only nice thing is Sharon Tate, a tall, really great-looking girl, who for most of the movie wanders around wearing glasses, which of course means that no one, including Martin, who's supposedly in a state of constant excitement, notices that she is beautiful." During this period, Sharon received recognition as a promising newcomer in the industry. She earned a Golden Globe Award nomination for New Star of the Year Actress for her role in Valley of the Dolls, and secured fourth place in the Golden Laurel Awards for Most Promising Newcomer, following Mia Farrow, Judy Geeson, and Katherine Newton. Additionally, she was named runner-up to Lynn Redgrave in the Motion Picture Herald's poll for The Star of Tomorrow, where box office success was primary criterion. These prizes signaled an acceleration in her career, reflecting in her negotiation of $150,000 fees for her next film. That's so much money during that time. Like, even the $750 a week was a lot. But $150,000, that was the top-notch Hollywood earners.
She was a big deal.
Yeah, she truly was. Towards the end of 1968, Sharon found out that she was pregnant. Both Roman and her were so excited to become parents. They decided to relocate to 10050 Cielo Drive in Benedict Canyon, Los Angeles. And on February 15th of 1969, they moved in. Previously occupied by their friends Terry Melker and Candace Bergen, Tate was elated by the availability of the house, affectionately dubbing it her love house. Despite concerns about the presence about strange individuals at their gatherings, the Polanskis continued to host large gatherings at their new residence, maintaining their popularity amongst friends. This is one of the two connections Sharon and Roman had to the Manson family, but the only one that's 100% provable. Charles Manson originally wanted to be a musician, and when he met Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys, they got along well. So well, in fact, that Dennis allowed the Manson family to briefly live with him, and ended up introducing Charles Manson to record producer Terry Melcher. Manson had written the song Never Learn Not to Love, which the Beach Boys recorded, crediting it to Dennis. I feel like that's something that not a lot of people know. But if you're listening to that song, now you know who actually wrote it.
Unless you're like really deep in Beach Boys lore, you probably don't know that.
Yeah, I feel like that's something that the regular Beach Boy fan probably doesn't really know about. Or maybe you don't want to know about. I mean, I could see that aspect too. However, Terry didn't see any potential and turned Manson down for a record deal. Some say that this was why he chose the house on Cielo Drive for the murders, not knowing that Terry had moved out almost a year prior.
Encouraged by positive reviews of her comedic performances, Sharon opted for the comedy film The 13 Chairs as her next project, largely due to the opportunity to co-star with Orson Welles, the Citizen Kane guy!
Yes, I mean, I would have taken that. No matter what the movie would have been about, I would be like, of course I'm in. That must have been amazing.
Orson Welles, sure. In March of 69, Sharon traveled to Italy for production, while Polanski headed to London to work on The Day of the Dolphin. Initially, Roman advised Sharon to prioritize her health and remain at home instead of working. However, she adamantly refused and accompanied him to London in March, then proceeded to Rome on her own. Throughout the shoot, director Nicholas Gessner and Luciano Luis Signani had to employ numerous tactics to conceal her growing baby bump. Sharon would have morning sickness and lacked the energy and agility required for action scenes. Many days, she could be found resting off-screen with her swollen feet propped up. When filming wrapped in late July, Sharon flew back to London to be with Roman. During her time in the city, Terry O'Neill shot candids of her shopping for baby clothes, opening baby shower gifts, and reveling in her future motherhood. The charm of these images lies in Sharon's childlike demeanor. This was the same woman who, not long before, shared with a reporter her sentimental attachment to childhood things, like her teddy bear and old Valentine's candy boxes, saying that if she were to part with them, it would feel like relinquishing her identity. Due to her advanced pregnancy, Sharon returned to the States by boat aboard the Queen Elizabeth II, reassured by Roman's promise to join her shortly.
At this point, we'd like to issue another trigger warning. The next part will discuss murder and violence, so if that's something you don't want to listen to today, please skip ahead or stop the episode here. The events of the night of August 8th in 1969 at 10050 Cielo Drive remain shrouded in mystery. The couple's friend, Wojciech Frykowski and Abigail Folger, had been occupying the house while Sharon and Roman were in Europe, and at Roman's request, they agreed to continue staying there until his return. Winifred Chapman, who cleaned the house daily, arrived as usual in the morning. Polanski called around 11 a.m. to check in, assuring his pregnant wife that he would be home by the beginning of the following week. In an effort to lift her spirits during her final weeks of pregnancy, Sharon invited her two friends, Joanna Pettit and Barbara Lewis, over for lunch. They departed around 3:30 p.m., and later that evening, Jay Sebring visited. I just want to add here that while we haven't talked about Jay in a little bit, he was always close with Sharon. After they broke up, they remained close friends, and Jay often accompanied the couple around town.
Besides Sharon, Jay, Abby Folger, and Wojciech, there were two more on the property that night. William Gerritsen, the caretaker, made his way to the guest house around 8:30 p.m., still feeling the effects of a hangover. By this time, Sharon and her friends decided to dine at the El Coyote Cafe on Beverly Boulevard. According to waitress Kathy Palmer, the group left sometime around 10. Just before midnight, Steve Parent visited William Gerritsen at the guest house. The two met a few weeks earlier when Gerritsen hitched a ride to the estate from Steve. After chatting over a couple beers, Parent made a quick phone call and informed Gerritsen of his departure. He then left in his white Rambler, driving up the driveway and stopping to activate the automatic gate.
That's where he met Tex Watson, member of the Manson family. For those of you who have never heard about the Manson family, let me explain who they were and how all of this came to be. The Manson family was a cult led by Charles Manson in the late 1960s. Manson was, as earlier mentioned, a failed music artist and had, in the late 1960s, started gathering many young people, especially women around him, who were loyal to him and did as he told him. Manson believed in an apocalyptic race war he called, in quotes, helter skelter, and manipulated his followers into carrying out violent acts in hope of inciting this war. I know this all sounds pretty insane and like something out of a Hollywood movie, but as gruesome as it is, it's what happened. A lot of these young women would later state that they were brainwashed into doing what they did, with Charles Manson preying on their vulnerability. But all of that didn't matter that one fateful night in August of 1969.
Neither Charles Manson nor his followers knew who lived in the house or who was present on the estate that night. However, Tex had been to the estate before. That's probably how he knew the floor plan of the house. He shot Stephen dead. He was just 18 years old.
Tex Watson then signaled to the three other family members accompanying him, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Linda Kasabian, to follow him up the driveway to the house. Upon reaching the home, Kasabian appeared visibly shaken, prompting Watson to instruct her to return to the car while he and the other two women proceeded to carry out their tasks. While only being there for this first little bit, Linda Kasabian played a significant role in the prosecution of the other Manson family members. She was granted immunity for her testimony as a key witness against the other Manson family members. Therefore, she was one of the two people who were on the property that evening who didn't die or spent the rest of their life in prison. She died in January of last year in Washington. The murders were gruesome, so we don't want to get into too much detail here. Sharon and Jay were stabbed and strangled, while Abigail and Wojciech were both stabbed multiple times on the lawn while trying to escape. Susan Atkins used some of Sharon's blood to write the word pig on the front door. She later stated that when she dipped her fingers in the blood, she could hear gurgling sounds, like blood flowing into the body out of the heart.
Oh my God.
It's, the details are so gruesome on this. Incredibly, even though Sharon was stabbed 16 times, not a single stab wound injured her baby, a little boy who died of lack of oxygen about 20 minutes after his mother's death. Roman would name him Paul Richard Polanski. The three got in the car where Linda Kasabian was waiting, and all four of them vanished into the night.
That's so upsetting. The next morning at around 8 o'clock, Winifred Chapman arrived at the property. She discovered nothing short of a bloodbath. She called the police, who arrested a sleepy William Gerritsen, who was still at the guest house. He somehow slept through everything. He was kept in custody for 2 more days, questioned, given a polygraph test, but the police realized he wasn't involved and let him go. Upon learning of the murders over the phone, Roman Polanski rushed back to California. The paparazzi soon arrived. Before the day was done, the world knew of Sharon Tate's tragic death, and people started to ask questions. Quote, "Sharon, it was fantastic what they were attributing to her in death. They made a monster out of the sweetest, most innocent, lovable human being. She was kindness itself to everybody and everything around her. People, animals, everything," Roman later said in an interview.
Roman, with the help of Sharon's family, planned a traditional Catholic funeral, and Sharon was buried holding her baby boy in her arms. Even on the day of her burial, the press speculated as to the nature of the gruesome murders. One television news report announced, in quotes, "It's been a day of farewell to the victims of a shooting and stabbing rampage that included actress Sharon Tate and 4 others. There was talk of drugs and the mad killer, but the Los Angeles police reports no developments in the search for a killer or killers that cut the telephone lines to the home in Benedict Canyon and carried out what police are describing as a methodical and ritualistic mass murder. All 5 victims died of multiple stab wounds, gunshots, and bludgeoning. Miss Tate and Jay Sebring were found in the living room bound together by a white nylon rope. Tate in her bikini bra and panties was hung before her death."
Because of how gruesome and out of anything anyone could have ever imagined this crime to be, speculation started quickly. Soon people gossiped about what happened and threw out names. Even John Phillips of the Mamas and the Papas came up. To my knowledge, police wasted a lot of time considering this theory. Yes. Some thought the group took part in black magic and drugs, and there was some Jamaican hip to voodoo who brought into Frykowski's drug operation. It was just insane. Roman agreed to a Life magazine article with photos of him sitting next to the door with the word pig smeared on it. He's also seen in the living room with blood spattered everywhere. The article wrote, quote, "You wouldn't believe how weird these people were. If you live like that, what do you expect? Their circle may have been friendly enough to protect them in their lifetime, but now in their posthumous notoriety, rumor had revealed them to all the connoisseurs of depravity, figures torn from life that was pure façade with videotape machines in the bedrooms. If I were Roman, I would be incensed if I agreed to an article, yes. If I agreed to pose photos at the crime scene of the death of my wife and mother of my future child, and they wrote that?
Yeah.
I would be irate.
And I read in a lot of sources that Roman did the article because of all these rumors, and he really wanted to clear the air, and he, like, said how it was and that they didn't do any black magic and that basically all of that was nonsense. And then they ended up writing this article and they published it with, like, pictures of the house and the blood on the door and everything. It must have been heartbreaking for him. And I honestly think that this and the quote from the article goes back to what we were talking about earlier and how the 1960s, even at the end of the decade, were still insanely close to the 1950s as far as the mindset went. The way that Sharon and Roman lived, how they went out to party and how free-spirited they were, was weird to most Americans who still lived a rather traditional life. I think what happened after their death is horrible, but because they didn't fit the social standard, the rumors about them were gruesome. By the end of 1969, most members of the Manson family had been arrested for what police thought was a big car theft ring. This is another thing that people often get hung up about when talking about Sharon's death. Why did it take the police so long to figure out what happened? The night after the Tate murders, six members of the Manson family, including Tex Watson and Charles Manson himself, murdered the LaBiancas, a couple living in the same area as Sharon and Roman did. It took the police ages to figure out how these two murders were connected, even though they were executed similarly. But finally, the police had a major breakthrough when someone reported what Atkins had told her. Susan Atkins had bragged about her role in several murders, saying that she and the Manson family had been up to no good. Soon they were arrested after initially being let go for the car theft thing. On June 15th in 1970, the trial began. It was a bizarre happening, with the Manson family members wearing long dresses and singing songs. They were constantly disruptive throughout the entire trial, and many questioned whether they wanted to appear insane or whether they really were insane. Eventually, after Linda Kasabian was granted immunity in return for her testimony, she told prosecutors what had happened, and Charles Manson, Susan Atkins, Tex Watson, and Patricia Krenwinkel were each charged with 7 counts of murder.
On January 25th, 1971, the jury returned a guilty verdict against all 4 defendants on all counts against them. On April 19th, the judge sentenced them to death. However, before this could be carried out, the California Supreme Court abolished the death penalty. This meant their sentences were converted to life in prison with the possibility of parole. Every few years, those incarcerated members of the Manson family apply for parole. I say incarcerated because despite Charles's death a few years back, the family still exists.
Yes, they were very young back then. They were like 20, 21, and so of course they're still alive and they've like spent pretty much their entire life in prison.
Sharon's mother Doris, her sisters Patty and Deborah, devoted their lives to raising awareness and hosting petitions, making sure the Manson family is never freed. Doris, who had such a close bond with Sharon, passed in July of 1992. She was buried next to her daughter and grandson. Sharon's younger sister Patty pursued acting as well. She passed in 2000. PJ Tate died in 2005. To this day, Deborah Tate tells Sharon's story and continually advocates against the Manson family's release. After fleeing the country, Roman still lives and works in Paris.
Looking back on Sharon's life, her former roommate Sheila Wells, with whom Sharon had shared an apartment at the beginning of her careers with both girls and their dogs living in a cramped little space, said, in quotes, "In just the last few months, Sharon was really beginning to come into her own. She never cared about being beautiful. She never even really cared about acting. She just wanted to love and be loved. I can't believe that the murderers knew her. To know Sharon, to really know her, was to love her. There's just no way that anyone who knew her could have hurt her." So that brings us to the end of the episode. Researching this episode was an emotional roller coaster for me. I have been fascinated by Sharon for so many years, and I feel like whenever there are stories of someone passing tragically and young, there's always the "what would have happened if." What would have happened if Sharon lived beyond that night? Would she have quit acting and stayed home with her child? Would she have gone back into acting and take on all these roles that she was so eager to play? In the end, we will never know, and no one will ever know.
Wow. I want to thank you all for tuning in to the first episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. I also want to thank modern technology for making it possible for a host from the United States and a host from Germany to collaborate on a project like this.
We would also like to thank our show's special friend, Michael Teggio, for the most wonderful intro tune.
We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life of the incredible Sharon Tate.
As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you hear, you should subscribe to this podcast. There should be a button somewhere around here, I don't know, and review us on your favorite streaming platform. Your feedback means the world to us and helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.